thank you guys for being here today. So like Dina said, I'm going to talk a little bit just kind of about the legal case, how it made its way through the American court system, and then kind of how we ended up at the Inter-American Commission, and then the implementation that's been done since the Inter-American Commission's decision came out in 2011. So just a little bit of background on kind of what happened that night.
Can you hear it fine?
Okay. So like you saw in the video, in June 1999, Simon abducted their three daughters, and Jessica called the police nine times over the course of 10 hours, and they essentially failed to respond to most of her calls, like she said. Eventually, Simon showed up in front of the police department and a shootout ensued, and he was shot dead, and the daughters' bodies were found in the back of the truck. So as you can see on the video, it talks about how the man dies in a shootout and the daughters were found dead, so it really makes this kind of seem like a personal, private family issue and really doesn't talk about the police role in the case. So this is the restraining order, the language that was on the restraining order that Jessica has had. So it says, a peace officer shall use every reasonable means to enforce a restraining order, and a peace officer shall arrest, or if an arrest would be impractical under the circumstances, seek a warrant for the arrest of the restrained person. So like I said, Jessica contacted the police nine times over the course of the night, and they basically told her they couldn't do anything. Like she said, they said she was ridiculous for calling them, that they were with their father, so everything was okay. So instead of investigating her cries for help, they responded to traffic violations, they did some paperwork, they filed a missing dog report, they went to dinner. They kind of did many other things besides respond to her. So like you saw on that the newspaper article, after the fact, the public attention really focused on Jessica's family dynamics and not how the police mishandled the case. And this kind of shows the stereotypes and misunderstandings that are really historic in domestic violence cases. So the Castle Rock police chief at the time said in an interview on 60 Minutes, what safer place could children be than with one of their parents, the mother or the father? So this really speaks to this idea that this is a family issue, and they didn't think that anything was wrong since they were with their father. So the case made its way. It was dismissed on both claims. So there was a substantive due process and a procedural due process claim. Both were dismissed at the district court. Jessica and her attorney at the time appealed, and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals actually reversed the procedural due process claim. But they, relying on the DeShaney case, which was kind of a similar case, which we can talk about more during the Q&A if you want, they actually affirmed the dismissal of the substantive due process claim. So it ended up making its way up to the Supreme Court, who actually reversed the 10th Circuit. And essentially what Scalia said, writing for the majority, was that we do not believe that these provisions of Colorado law truly made enforcement of restraining orders mandatory. So like Jessica said, he was basically saying that restraining orders don't need to be enforced, so they're not really worth anything. As you can imagine, this really sparked outrage across the country, so it outraged domestic violence, women's rights, and civil rights attorneys, and it sent the message that restraining orders do not have to be enforced. And it kind of fostered this idea that police can do what they want, that they can have discretion in these cases, which is really what restraining orders were meant to do, to kind of remove that discretion from the police officer. So they, you know, were supposed to enforce the restraining order, which is a lot of what the dissent in the Supreme Court talks about. It also left Jessica deprived of her day in court because the way the case made its way up to the Supreme Court was on a motion to dismiss. So she never got to engage in discovery, never really got to study the evidence. And most people, including her attorneys at the time, really thought, as most people would, that once you get to the Supreme Court, that's kind of the end of the road. So then you can do advocacy and kind of other things around it. But once the Supreme Court has spoken, that's where most people would leave it. But Jessica, together with her mom, Tina, decided that wasn't enough. So with her counsel at the ACLU and at the Columbia Human Rights Clinic at the time, they decided to bring a petition before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So the commission is a group of seven human rights experts from across the Americas, and they look at petitions that claim that countries have violated their human rights under international treaties. So with respect to the United States, they're looking at the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. It's based in Washington, D.C., and the way it works is you submit a petition, and if you kind of have exhausted all of your local domestic remedies, which Jessica had at that point, and the petition is granted, you're kind of given a hearing, and they essentially issue what's called a merits report, which is really just like a court decision. So when you look at kind of the international compared to the domestic legal frameworks, the DeShaney case kind of sets it up so that the government has no responsibility to protect individuals from private acts of violence, even when they know that there's a clear and preventable threat. And this stands in stark contrast to international law, which really states that states have a responsibility when they knew or ought to have known that there was a real or immediate risk and when they fail to take reasonable steps to prevent the harm. So in Jessica's case, the commission found that the United States had in fact violated both her and her daughter's rights under the American Declaration. So the right to life, the right to equal protection and non-discrimination, special protections for children, and due process and judicial protection. So not only when the police failed to respond to her cries for help was that a violation, but then when the court system failed to offer her any kind of remedy, that was also a violation. Petitioners allege that the failure of the U.S. government, they had failed to exercise due diligence because, like I just said, they failed to enforce her restraining order, they failed to protect her three daughters, and the systemic level, there was failure across the systemic level to protect women from domestic violence. So here's just some language from the decision, which is kind of interesting. So, thinking back to the few slides before, comparing DeShaney to kind of international standards, the Inter-American Commission stated that a state may incur international responsibility for failing to act with due diligence to prevent, investigate, sanction, and offer reparations for acts of violence against women, and this includes acts committed by private actors. And another interesting thing that the decision did was it really looked at the intersectionality of domestic violence. So not only was this a women's issue, but when minority groups or ethnic or racial groups are targeted, they tend to be discriminated against even more. And the commission stated that states must adopt the required measures to modify the social and cultural patterns of conduct of men and women and to eliminate prejudices, customary practices, based on the idea of inferiority or superiority of the stereotyped roles for men and women. So the commission, again, it kind of showed that the failure to act by the court system was also a violation and that they had failed to provide her with adequate and effective judicial remedies. So at the end of the decision, the Inter-American Commission offers 7 recommendations, 3 of which are individual and 4 which are more systemic or kind of policy-level recommendations. So the 3 individual remedies were that there should be an investigation done into the daughter's death. So I'm not sure it said during the video, but there was proof that there were bullet wounds from multiple guns and no investigation was done into which bullets caused their death. An investigation into the systemic police failure, so why no one responded to her calls, and then also to offer her and her family reparations. And then there were also some policy remedies that they recommended, so essentially that protective orders should protect women, that protective orders should protect the children who are caught up in these situations, that on a systemic level, the U.S. needs to address stereotypes and discrimination regarding domestic violence victims, and that investigations into missing children in domestic violence contexts must occur. So my professor kind of talks about the why bother question. So like Dina mentioned, the Inter-American Commission kind of has, there's no teeth here in the United States. So they offer this decision, they make these recommendations, but the U.S. doesn't actually have to comply with anything. So I'll talk a little bit in a second about what we're doing to push compliance with the decision. But there's also value in just bringing this case and kind of the movement that it galvanizes across the country. So it offers some sort of redress and empowerment for women and communities. It really was a focal point for coalition and movement building across the country. So like I said, you know, DV advocates across the country kind of use this case to build some momentum. There's been some movement on the policy level at the state, federal, and international levels. It's a tool for exerting political pressure, and it can really influence and shift public opinion. So even though the the decision is not binding, there is definitely some kind of moral and political weight associated with what the commission said. So one of the things that came out of the decision is DOJ actually ended up doing some investigations into police departments across the country. So they've investigated the Puerto Rico, the New Orleans, and the Maricopa County police departments and found that there are systemic patterns and practices of discriminatory policing, including gender-biased policing in their response to domestic violence. And in the Puerto Rico Police Department in particular, they actually found that there was a pretty decent gender-based violence within the police department themselves. So they were, in fact, the perpetrators. So these are just some of the language from those decisions. So the New Orleans Police Department engaged in a pattern and practice of general discrimination in their under-enforcement and under-investigation of violence against women, and the Puerto Rico Police Department failed to adequately address sexual assault in Puerto Rico. So both the New Orleans Police Department and the Puerto Rico Police Department have entered into consent decrees between themselves and the DOJ to respond and investigate reports of sexual assault in a more professional, effective, and gender-based way. So another thing that has come out of the decision is that advocates have been working together with DOJ on guidance to law enforcement's response to domestic and sexual violence. It kind of just gives them a framework for how to deal with these issues in a more appropriate way. So you see domestic and sexual violence policies and trainings, how to investigate, and what officers can really do. And another thing that kind of has come out of this decision, maybe not as directly, is that local domestic violence and human rights resolutions are popping up around the country. So in Miami, we have two, actually, in Montgomery County, Alabama, which is kind of interesting, in Cincinnati, Baltimore, and then one was recently passed in the past few weeks in Washington, D.C., that claim that there's a fundamental right to be free from domestic violence, and many of them actually cite to Jessica's case as part of their language. And what's interesting about some of them is, so the recognition of domestic violence as a human right, freedom from domestic violence as a fundamental human right, and some of them actually have a little bit more teeth than just kind of stating that it's a fundamental human right. So the Miami-Dade County Resolution has a charge to all local government agencies to incorporate these principles into their policies and practices. So one of the things that we're working on as a clinic now is how we can kind of implement these local resolutions. So we now have something on the books that declare freedom from domestic violence as a fundamental human right, and how can we use that in our local communities to start making some progress. So some things we're thinking about and working on are extending the VAWA housing protections. So right now in federally subsidized housing, there's some protections for victims of domestic violence. So for example, they can't be evicted if they bring kind of noise and disturbance to the property. If the housing is under their partner's name, if that's how they get the subsidy, they can bifurcate the lease, but that doesn't always transfer into the state-subsidized housing. So we're thinking of ways we can kind of use that language and those protections in more of the state system. And then similarly, we're also thinking of ways we can use this in child custody disputes. So making sure that because a woman is unable to protect her child from violence because of the situation she's in herself, how can we make sure that the children are not taken away from her? So I'm going to leave it there for now and turn it over to Jessica.
Thank you, Charlotte. So thanks very much for that very clear description of the legal issues at stake. We wanted to ask you, Jessica, we'd like to talk about the implementation issue, but to start with, would you talk a little bit about the experience of bringing your case to the Inter-American Commission?
Sure. Well, I want to say good morning and thank you. Thank you for being involved and showing up. That's half the battle, at least for me. You know, I think when I realized the impact that the ridiculousness of Scalia's decision from the Supreme Court came to be, and that was the worst depression I'd ever been in. And so I needed to find an outlet. I needed to believe in something where it came to anybody governing something, but not in our country. That was pretty evident after the Supreme Court. So when my attorney said, that's it, there's no more, there's nowhere else to go, I'm like, wait a minute, somebody else has a boss. Everybody's got a boss. Supreme's got a boss. Find them. So we ended up at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And, of course, the biggest thing is because there's no teeth and there's no obligation to tweak our laws or reform, conform, whatever, to their specifications and their recommendations, it's all, I think, personally, about shaming our government. And so when I went before the Inter-American Commission, it was the first time I was ever verbally heard in full, and in the full extent of what the tragedy in my life looked like and the long arm and the ripple effect that it's had throughout our country. But to be heard and was the number one thing for me. In any setting would have been like at least a voice that I was able to share in letting people know that these atrocities are happening, and if they're happening to me, they're going to happen to other people, and to not make ourselves exempt. But it gave me that platform in which to at least bring it to the limelight and to other people's attention, and I realized that our government isn't at all what we thought it was at that time. And so I went before the commission, and of course, you know, there's been very little done, and I will testify and go and sit before them every year till I'm old and gray. Well, I'm pretty gray already, but typically when I'm really old, I said, you guys can work with me and we can work as a team, or you can sit across from me and listen to me torture you every year, and I'll be here. And yeah, I don't give them any quarter whatsoever. I'm not playing nice anymore. I'm really, it's almost 14 years now. This video was at 9 years, and that was an extreme time frame for me. But in all of that, you know, for my loss, it was your gain as a society. And I think that that's what the whole thing was about, is bringing human rights into our civil rights and helping them meet head on. And maybe in meshing the two and marrying them, we can actually make sense of the mess our government's made of our country.
Jessica, yes. If I can ask another question.
Sure.
What would be acceptable to you as an outcome of the commission's mm-hmm. decision? I mean, you're in the process of trying to get the recommendations implemented. So why don't you talk a little bit about what you hope for out of the process and what would feel like a real win to you?
Like a win. I don't know that there's any win on a personal level that I would walk away other than to see that people are using human rights and incorporating them however they can in their infinite ability to assist us in getting our position made when we are looking for that assistance. I feel very strongly on behalf of our nation that we need to embrace the human rights that are available to us. And if we don't do it, then it's just a trend and it's going to go away. So that's the scary part. That's the part that I feel, what have I dedicated 14 years of my life to if we can't bring this mechanism into our world and put it to work? On a personal level, you know, I think I just would like to be a private citizen and actually have a home and just be able to, like, find some peace. That's all I want.
Thank you. You want to talk a little bit about the shall question? You know, the whole point about the restraining order and what came out of the Supreme Court's decision. We talked a little bit about that last night.
I don't know what that word shall means anymore. I thought I knew what it meant. I grew up Catholic, so shall was always in our you shall not. Or you must, I guess is the other word. And so we thought that when Colorado changed the language of the law, I believe in 1994, was it? No.
I'm not sure.
I don't know when. I don't think they're doing anything with it because everything they correct, there's another clause to upsert whatever is over here. And it just, like, is in conflict. They just need to clean it up and get rid of some stuff is what they need to do. But as far as the word shall goes, you know, even in our Constitution, as Dina had brought up this morning, and we've always based the case from the Constitution.
Actually,
and
this was from a student of mine who came last night. Just wanted to give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, but she was so perceptive in saying, what does this mean then? If it doesn't mean
in the Constitution, sorry to interrupt.
No, but what was her quote exactly? It was so fascinating.
She pointed out, this is Tawny from the clinic, she went home afterwards and looked up the Constitution, and in Article 1, it says that any bill or law that is drafted by Congress shall be put before the president before it is passed into law.
Thank you.
She didn't really think that that was the way that the Supreme Court understood the shall.
Right. So I guess, you know, that's where we're at with the language of the law in Colorado, is trying to make heads or tails of what our rights really are. And then, of course, they don't want you to, like, protect yourself. And if you hurt your abuser, then you end up in prison, and there again, you're victimized. So they're not giving us a whole lot of quarter where it comes to knowing what. It's not black and white. They leave a gray area of question, and I just don't know where our country is. I don't know where we sit with the protective orders and the idea that there's no obligation, and how far the word shall in this one instance has taken us back from the Supreme Court so many years of fighting for those protective orders and that right. And the idea that, you know, we are not utilizing all of the tools in our bag somehow. And because every time an attorney or an advocate in Colorado tries to help my case, the Colorado laws put a quick stop to that. So it's a very frustrating situation to be in, because you're bound and tied. There's no wiggle room whatsoever. And it's a tough state. Their laws, if you break them, It's terrible. And once they have you in their grasp, they don't let you go. So the word shall, I'm not sure. What I thought it meant and all that it carried, I don't know that it has that ability anymore. I mean, they've usurped every attempt we have made to impress on them that they are promising to serve and to protect, and they're doing none of that. And they don't care. They simply don't care.
Would you like to talk a little bit about the importance of lawyers, and to actually say something about how your case went all the way up? This is a very interesting story about your defense, your lawyer from the very beginning.
Oh.
And then maybe bring it all the way back to the group here.
That was quite a moment in my world, because my 180 days were starting to go away. And that was the only time allotted between, you know, the period of intent to sue and finding an attorney. And in Colorado, because it's a good old boy state, and this judge is on city council, and it goes on and on and on, and everybody's got more than one vote where it comes to most any decision, that, Dina, ask the question again.
Well, you know, the fact that you had a mortgage attorney, for example. Talk about
Brian.
Your defense and how you wound up with that, going up to Supreme Court.
It was really odd.
Jumped on the bandwagon.
Right. Brian Reichel was a mortgage attorney. And we filed, he's the one who took my case to the Supreme Court.
And why was that?
Because he was the only one who had a bigger heart and the guts to, like, come out and say, I will fight this case for you. This is totally wrong. But it did. I mean, I literally picked up the phone book and just said, I'm going to call any attorney. I'd been to over 10 attorneys in a short amount of time, like maybe a week and a half. And nobody wanted to take it because it was in conflict with Castle Rock, or, you know, and everybody does not want to cut off their nose to spite their face where they're colleagues are concerned in Colorado, where they should be less concerned about that and more concerned about a client, I think. But lo and behold, Brian, by the grace of God, I believe Brian was put in my lap. So a year to the date in 2000, June 23rd, ironically enough, was our filing date. And it took me a long time to understand the processes. But gosh, to file my own intent to sue and to have to put a number on my children's heads and their life to be able to sue was the hardest thing, to have to come up with a figure in the millions on my children's lives. And that was hard. That was so hard for me. So unfortunately, that's how our government works, I guess. But I think then the ACLU contacted Brian from New York, and, you know, they served a great purpose in getting everything prepared from the Supreme Court up to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and making sure that we had that support. And, of course, at some point the ACLU does not have the power to always do what they think they can do. So sometimes they're not always... I love the ACLU, but we have differences of opinion. I mean, I don't represent everything that they represent. But again, after the ACLU, Carrie moved away from there to Columbia. And the law school at Columbia. And we worked there with Peter Rosenblum for quite a while. And I think that was my favorite part of it all, was working at Columbia. It was quite an honor. And we worked many years. It was difficult to leave, to go to Miami. But I did choose to stay with Carrie as my head attorney. I had a rapport with her that I didn't find with other attorneys. And so naturally it was a good fit. And without her, I don't know that we would have made the leaps and bounds that we have. I mean, I don't see the payoff right now, but I do know that our country is starting to pick up the momentum in the fact that all of us could be subjected, and our children, our grandchildren, our sisters, our brothers, our mothers, and really personalize it. And I feel like it's not my case now. It's all of our case. It has my name on it, but does it not apply to all? And how do we work human rights into our own world to begin that process? Because we've got to teach our next generation what that means to them. Otherwise, it's lost. And we go right back to the good old boys. And I don't know how to do that. I've lost too much. I don't even vote anymore, but I was encouraged highly to vote last night. But I know I was very much a reader, and I used to spend months looking at the ballots and what I was going to vote for, and flying, it just doesn't matter. Does it really matter? No. But on the other hand, they can take our right to vote just as easily as they gave it to us. So I don't know how I feel about that.
Do you want to say something to a group of budding lawyers, law students?
I'm going to hammer you just for a second. All right. But let's look at it from a client's point of view. Like, I think that I felt like I was just a number to a lot of attorneys. Like, there was no face, there was no individuality, no story that pulsed them into wanting to do the right thing. Thank God that I, eventually found the right attorneys. But I think that what I've recognized is that attorneys can sometimes stereotype and get overwhelmed with the sadness of the tragedy and the trauma that will come to your desk, and how we all are individuals and that we all need that care and that attention, and that we give you our voice when we hire you or you volunteer to help. And the outcome from your decision to do the job to your best ability and to listen is going to affect your client's life for the rest of their lives. Where you may forget about the outcome of that client, but that client is expecting you to be their voice and get what they need from what they're requesting. I don't know if I'm making my point, but I just feel like there's a certain respect that we need to have in that as client-attorney relationships, and to see them as people, human beings, and not just another sad story, because they're all going to be sad stories. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a job. That's kind of sad in itself, because we need you. I would not be where I am today without my student team throughout the years. Thank God for them. I feel, as a country, would have never had the ability and the knowledge without the students. And that means you as students as well. And I would hope that if you have any thoughts on the word shall, which seems to be the holdup at this particular junction of the game, and it is a game all across the board, but I'm kind of done playing. I want to win this one. Mm-hmm. I don't like the game anymore. I'm not having any more fun. But I do believe that we as a society need to figure out what the decision from the Supreme Court means to us and how to skirt around it or change it. I don't know. Everybody tells me everything's impossible, but I don't believe that. It's only impossible because we hear it and, you know, absorb that. And I just don't buy that the Supreme Court was right and that we should suffer those consequences as a people. So that is my question to you, is if you have any feedback on how to actually, I don't know if it was up to me, I'd ask you all to write letters to the Supreme Court and indulate them with opinion. They want opinion, let's give them one. But it's up to us. It's really up to us to find out where human rights belongs in our own personal lives first.
Thank you, Charlotte.
I just wanted to say something about kind of the attorney-client relationship, that Jess was just speaking about. So one thing I failed to mention when I was talking is that since the commission's decision came out, the petitioner, so all of her counsel, have engaged in what are called working meetings with the Inter-American Commission. So these happen about once a year, and we actually have one tomorrow in D.C., and it's a time for the commission to kind of mediate a conversation between representatives from the state. So it's people from the State Department and DOJ, and then represent their kind of delegate to the commission together with Jess and her counsel. And at most of those meetings, Jess is not present. So a lot of the times the lawyers will kind of show up with their legal arguments and very prepared, as we all always are, with kind of what we expect to get done. And last time, so we were supposed to have a working meeting in October, and it was canceled and then rescheduled because of the government shutdown. So we kind of knew the government was going to show up and say, we're just here, but we're not in a position to say anything, which is exactly what happened. So we decided to bring Jess along with us. And I think it was really important for all of us to realize that this is still her case, and this we kind of got where we are because of her tragedy. And she was also able to say things that none of us would be able to say to these representatives. So not only was her presence in the room just very powerful to kind of put the face on what we were all there for, but to really hold their feet to the fire in a way that lawyers can't. So I think that was a really interesting and important thing to remember while we were doing this.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Let's just open it now.
Well, may I say something?
Please do, yeah.
We met with the Special Rapporteur on Women, Tracy Robinson, the same day prior to our working meeting. And the fascinating thing was...
She works for the U.S.
The U.N. Special Rapporteur?
No, the U.N. Special Rapporteur is Rashida, mind you.
So Tracy Robinson is the Inter-American Commission
Rapporteur. Okay. So I knew she was in that category, but... excuse me, everyone. But I feel that at first they were feigning this whole thing from their point of view, that they couldn't even apply the date of January 30th to meet with Tracy Robinson that was not their position. They couldn't do it. But they, at the end of the meeting, they were pretty happy to comply with at least January 30th and meeting. And that was just a weird thing to me that they held this attitude of we've got no, you know, obligation or authority to commit to anything. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, maybe January 30th. And I'm like, yippee.
And they met, you mean to say that they came and met with Tracy Robinson with you, the State Department people?
So we had kind of a pseudo working meeting, but it was kind of, they were just not prepared because it was a few days after the government shutdown. So there was kind of this on the record conversation where it's usually a delegation of about 10 people. This time it was 3, and all they really said was we're not in a position to say anything. And then after, off the record, there was a much more personal connection, and kind of they agreed to have an actual working meeting with substance tomorrow. So that's kind of how that came about.
I think that was the first time I really lost it, honestly. I'll tell you a funny story. To me, this is hilarious. I don't know if it's so funny to my attorneys, but to me, it's great. And you'll get clients like me. Prepare yourself. Get up. And I'm not such a bad person. I'm just really pushy. I'm very tenacious. But what was funny was that I had this 5-page speech that was supposed to be like 15 minutes. And I think I did it in 4.5, and I just hammered them. I had them all crying or mad or something. Mm-hmm. But I had all this stuff coming at me. I was like, hello, I have arrived. I'm not playing nice with you. I'm not going to be courteous. I'm not going to say please, and I'm not going to say thank you until you do something to be thanked for. And I was just rough all around the board. I made one of them cry, one of them mad, and one of them was just dumbfounded all across the way. And I had such a blast. But then I cracked up because then it went into like the Inter-American Commission talking about the women in Mexico being abducted and sold into slavery, and that just changed the whole happy into oh, you know. But it was a blast to just kind of let them just, I never have done that. Never. And I just lost my cool. Because the mad lady, I don't know her name. I got to see her again. It's a happy birthday to me. I'm not looking forward to this. Yeah, all day. Nah, we're not talking about that. That means you have to know Ola. But she was so angry, and she was like, we have never kept you from coming into our door and speaking to Colorado. And I started to, like, I could feel the heat rising. And Carrie, thank God, she was like a mother eagle swooping in, and she never loses it. And she did not lose it, but she, like, shut her up. It was like, just shut your trap. Because I think Carrie would have reached over and smacked her in her whole face, you know? She hadn't stopped. So but it was probably the most confrontational of meetings that I've ever experienced in all these years. And maybe that's what it takes.